This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the new report that the Center for Constitutional Rights did on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's quite an operation. What ALEC is doing strikes at the very heart of representative democracy. We'll also talk about the compelling new movie, The Report, which is streaming on Netflix. The Report is a dramatization of the Senate's investigation of the CIA torture program. Heidi and I will first talk about our reaction to the movie, and then we're going to play an excerpt of the discussion that we had from August 2009. I think it's one of the best shows we've ever done.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
On December 4 of 2019, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the CCR, sued in Arizona a number of Arizona lawmakers who were participating in a closed meeting of the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC. ALEC brings together legislators, corporate leaders, conservative activists, and lobbyists to draft and promote model legislation across the country. On December 4, the date the suit was filed, ALEC was holding its annual States and Nations Policy Summit in Scottsdale, Arizona, an elite suburb outside of Phoenix. The complaint asked the court to find that attendance at the closed-door meetings for the purpose of deliberation on legislation with corporations and lobbyists by lawmakers from Arizona violates that state's open meetings law and asks that all notes and materials from the secretive meetings be made accessible to the public and for legislators to be enjoined from attending these meetings in the future. Dominic Renfrey of the CCR said, ALEC's pay-to-play model strikes at the very heart of democratic lawmaking. And not surprisingly, it is people of color and those on the margins that suffer the most from ALEC's attacks. We're joined today by Dominic Renfrey of the CCR. He helped organize the lawsuit. He's the advocacy program manager of the CCR. And we're also joined by Jacinta Gonzalez from Arizona. She's the senior campaign organizer of Magente, a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and a part of the National Immigrants' Rights Movement. Dom, Jacinta, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Dom, I want to start off by asking you several questions to set this up. Who are the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, and who are the defendants?
So the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are a mix of social and racial justice organizations based out of Arizona. We have Mijente, who Jacinta is with, who's joining us today. We have Puente, another migrant rights organization. We also have the Phoenix Metro chapter of Black Lives Matter. And we also have the Arizona-Palestine Solidarity Alliance.
Who are the defendants?
So the defendants is an interesting question in this case. So we're really trying to apply the lawsuit here to the lawmakers. We're really in our lawsuit pushing that it's the lawmakers themselves that need to be answerable to Arizona residents and voters. So they are the defendants in this case. It's the state legislature as a whole. Yeah.
Where did ALEC come from? Talk about its birth, please, and who now makes up its membership.
To understand ALEC is really to understand a push by evangelical Christian conservative activists going back to the 70s, the late 60s and the 70s. It was around that time that a number of activists, and one of them was Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich is most known for co-founding also the Heritage Foundation, as well as ALEC and many other right-wing institutions. And they were all founded around this early 70s period. The intention there was to found an organization that would bring evangelical Christians into politics. You'll remember, for those who studied that time or who were around then, will realize that evangelical Christian folks didn't see themselves as politically engaged as much as they do today. I mean, it was only really because of the efforts of a right-wing activist like Paul Weyrich that he kind of encouraged them to come in, and what he saw was an existential threat to American values coming out of the civil rights movement. So he founded a number of organizations to really engage voters from Christian evangelical communities. So he founded ALEC to push social conservative policy into the state law offices, the state houses across the country. It kind of went broke, basically, in the late 80s. They realized that the social policy doesn't really pay the bills. So they started to realize that there were corporations around this time really pushing to have more access at the political level. So it started initially almost by accident, where ALEC found that its infrastructure was very helpful to the tobacco industry to push back against the public and political attack that the tobacco industry was facing. And they realized they could actually sell what they do. And that's what they did, and they generated a lot of income by selling memberships to corporations. So today, it's very much made up of hundreds of different corporations and different corporate lobby institutions, as well as right-wing conservative Christian activists, as well as the lawmakers themselves. ALEC itself believes that it has a third of all state lawmakers as members. That's many thousand of state lawmakers across the country.
How does ALEC serve corporate and conservative policies?
So it really is a quid pro quo. I know that phrase is thrown around a lot these days, but this is one of the classic examples. I mean, you have ALEC realizing that its infrastructure engages politicians. So they sell access to politicians, to companies. So companies that have a particular regulation they want passed, maybe it's a privatization of a particular public entity, for example. We've seen that a lot with prisons. We've seen that ALEC has been a vehicle for the private prison industry to push for the privatization of incarceration. So they go into ALEC with a political law in mind, and they pay for access to sit down next to politicians in very quiet spaces, and they draft law behind closed doors, and then farm that law out, those model pieces of legislation out across the country. So it's a place where corporations can really go and draft laws with politicians. It's a great service for the corporate industry.
Jacinta, I want to bring you into the conversation. Why do you consider ALEC a threat to communities of color? You wrote that the impact of the activities of ALEC have been devastating on communities of color. What have they done to people in Arizona and immigrants in general?
No, ALEC has been behind some of the most harmful legislation that the U.S. has passed in the last couple of decades that have really increased mass incarceration and have fueled the deportation pipeline. So back in 2010, in Arizona, they passed what was what's called SB 1070, which is really the Show Me Your Papers law that created a really harsh anti-immigrant sentiment in Arizona. That was a whole culture of being able to create a sense of attrition through enforcement, that if you created a sentiment of living that was so miserable for immigrants in Arizona that they would themselves decide to leave. And so these types of policies of cruelty, of aggression, of having police officers enforce immigration laws really started within ALEC. So after SB 1070 was passed in Arizona, we had copycat bills in different states like Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina. And so we really kind of saw how they really were the vehicle for the anti-immigrant movement to put legislation in place that would attack communities of color, that would attack immigrants, and create a place that was very unhospitable for them to live. But we've also seen ALEC really promote the laws that have built up mass incarceration in the U.S. They created a lot of the sentencing issues that came up in the 94 crime bill that included three strikes law, truth in sentencing, that have created an environment that now in Arizona we have the fourth highest incarceration rate in the U.S. and have the highest Latinx incarceration rate because of these policies. And now they're trying to kind of reform that conversation and are introducing different forms of electronic surveillance or electronic monitoring or electronic shackles to now be able to control people. So when we really think of communities of color that have had, you know, a boot on their neck from police for many, many years, a lot of that activity has come because of ALEC's policies, whether they're around immigration, incarceration, or now surveillance.
Let's talk some more about these proliferating racist and exploitative policies that ALEC is promoting. Mm. Let's talk about the Stand Your Ground law, the voter ID law, mm-hmm. the anti-BDS laws, and the critical infrastructure laws. And I ask that question of both of you, Dom and Jacinta. Who would like to go first?
I can jump in on...
jump in.
Yeah, on the Stand Your Ground law. This is just symptomatic of many of these examples, as you read out there. And you can find more about that at alecattacks.org. There's a whole report into all of this that we put out last week. But for those of you who haven't kind of taken a look at that, you'll know that in 2005, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, as it does in Florida and many other states, was central to passing policies and laws within Florida that was very favorable to its members, its the gun manufacturing industry. In 2005, they pass a Castle Doctrine bill, which is exactly the same as Stand Your Ground. So they pass a Stand Your Ground bill, which basically what that means is that a regular citizen has no longer any legal need to retreat. It can just, when it feels a person feels in danger, they can shoot at someone. And as we see by the research that's borne this out, that gets applied much more against people of color. So those of you who remember the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement will remember the killing of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. And it was George Zimmerman's acquittal a few years ago that it was because of the Stand Your Ground law that it gave him legally, got him off the hook, really. And so it's just an example, and Stand Your Ground was proliferated across many states, and it has led to dramatic increase in gun violence. It's led to a racial disparity in acquittals of people charged under those laws for shooting people. I'll just touch on voter ID laws as well for a second. You see that in North Carolina, ALEC, again, is central to some of the proliferation of these voter ID bills, which disenfranchise communities of color from accessing the ballot. When a North Carolina voter ID bill went to the highest court in North Carolina, the court found that it had targeted African-American communities with, quote, surgical precision. It is a tool to disenfranchise black and brown communities from voting. So there's just two very clear examples of how ALEC has been central to the passage of laws at the state level that have really come down hard on black and brown communities.
Jacinta, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Well, I do think that the impact that ALEC has, even though we feel it so strongly in the U.S. and have felt it from everywhere, like some of the examples that are given, but also around issues of gender, access to you know, reproductive justice services, any sort of issue that relates to women's rights, they've also been incredibly harmful. But I think also internationally, their policies, both going back from, you know, not being supportive of boycotts that were helping to dismantle apartheid in South Africa, to now the BDS strategy in Palestine, has been very, very important in terms of how they've not only had an impact nationally and locally on some of these policies, but internationally as well, as people are trying to fight for racial justice and equality. So I think just the footprint of ALEC is incredibly large and harmful and should be kind of seen at a global scale.
I was shocked to learn that after the Dakota Pipeline actions, a number of critical infrastructure laws were passed. What was the relationship of ALEC to these critical infrastructure laws, and what do those laws do?
Absolutely. I mean, as Jacinta touched on, ALEC is remodeling itself and finding modern relevance to its membership. We see that with the critical infrastructure, and I'll go to that. But just to add something to what Jacinta said there about the Palestine rights movement in this country and the legal attacks on what is otherwise just a healthy American right to boycott, ALEC didn't just have a role in proliferating the anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctions laws. They've also now begun to get involved in the crackdown on Palestinian rights activists on university campuses. They're not letting go of this. They're very proud of their stance here. So for those of you following that debate, you can find information about that in the media. But on the critical infrastructure laws, I mean, this is really perhaps one of their more recent attempts to support their corporate members, namely in the oil and gas sector. Just as a by note here, ALEC has been central to the denial of climate change and funding so-called scientific institutions that have kept, for corporate profit, have kept this doubt about climate change as they see it in the press and in research. They've been behind about this effort for a long time. When we see Standing Rock break out in 2016 and the indigenous and non-indigenous allies who came to really say, and enough is enough here, the fossil fuel build-out is threatening treaty lands that indigenous people have recognized with the U.S. Government. But also, I mean, the whole world is in this climate crisis. What we see, ALEC doesn't decide, okay, we're on the wrong side of history. No, they double down. We see in Oklahoma, the day after the final camp was moved, displaced in Standing Rock, we see Oklahoma's state lawmakers pass a law that they justify as a response to Standing Rock to radically criminalize what is otherwise just peaceful protest activity. And it's no surprise that has a big impact on people of color, namely in this case, indigenous people. ALEC takes that idea, and this is classic of ALEC. It doesn't necessarily always begin these ideas, but it vacuums up the most radical ideas happening in a particular state and then broadcasts them and platforms them out nationally. So we see Oklahoma comes up with this legal response. It gets introduced into ALEC, and then we see in a very short period of time, about 18 months, up to 13 states pass versions of this critical infrastructure law. And the CCR is legally representing a woman called Anne Whitehead at the moment, who's facing 10 years in prison for a just peaceful protest activity, standing on a pipeline easement. That's how ALEC will operate and serve its membership. Oil and gas sector goes to ALEC and says, we need our lawmakers to support this bill in many states. Louisiana picks up that bill. 1 week after the critical infrastructure law passes into law in Louisiana, what was otherwise just a misdemeanor is now someone looking at a felony charge, and she's facing two felony charges, which would be 10 years of jail that she's facing. I mean, these are radical steps for otherwise, I mean, I'm sure some of your listeners have engaged in a peaceful walking protest somewhere at some point in time. How could you imagine doing that and being arrested and then facing 10 years in jail? I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
For those of you who've just joined us, we're speaking with Dominic Renfrey of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who helped organize the lawsuit, and with Jacinta Gonzalez from Arizona, who's active in the movement out there and what ALEC has done to them. Jacinta, why do you think that ALEC resembles the elements of what you call a shadow state apparatus? You call it corporate capture.
You know, organizations like ALEC allow corporations to really create policies that are then both lining their own pockets but creating destruction in other communities. And so we really see it as a place where it isn't actually lawmakers being able to make decisions around policy based on what's best for their constituents and their communities. They're actually in a situation where they're being influenced by corporate interests and being influenced by the monies that corporations offer them, that then create policies that benefit, again, corporations and capitalist practices and not communities that are directly impacted by them. And so for us, seeing this kind of corporate capture where we see, you know, the tech companies, the oil companies, the transportation and development companies that are going to make the most money off of these practices setting the policy, we see that as a situation where democracy is being directly attacked. And, you know, people's vote no longer counts when they know that their lawmaker is going to be corrupted by the money of these corporations.
You call it pay to play. Jacinta, how does ALEC get funded?
I think Dom can give kind of a clear answer on how the structure works. But from my understanding, a lot of it is that the members themselves pay to be part of ALEC. But then we see that a lot of these same corporations then make donations to different campaigns, to different elected officials. And there's sort of that vicious cycle where people are kind of trading favors in order to be able to pass these laws.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, where we see it play out specifically with ALEC is they have these meetings which have just general conversations, but where the real stuff is done is in so-called ALEC task forces. Now, corporations pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get involved in these task forces, and that's why we really call it pay-to-play. They're paying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to get access to these private rooms, these task forces, where they sit together with these lawmakers and draft these laws. So that it really is a pay. They pay to get access to that room, and then they sit with those lawmakers and draft out those laws, which the public doesn't know anything about. And then they'll find their way into state houses across the country. And I just want to spell it out for your listeners. What they're actually producing here is a completely finished law. The only thing that's open is the name of the state. I mean, that's how complete they're making these things, yeah.
How many state legislatures are members of ALEC, and how many corporations?
So ALEC claims that it's up to a third, and I think that's been verified by independent analysis.
A third of all state legislatures?
A third of all. So if my numbers are right, that's almost... So the total number of lawmakers is around top of 7,000, maybe 8,000. So we're talking somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 of these lawmakers would consider them, what ALEC would consider them members, which is quite a staggering figure. I mean, they've been around 46 years now, so they're ahead of us a little bit on that.
Yeah. How many corporations are members of ALEC?
Also difficult to put an exact number because they operate very, very privately, but the estimates on that are several hundred. There were a number of corporations that were pressured to leave ALEC by the good work of Color of Change and a number of other organizations, the Center for Media and Democracy. There was a campaign running right after the killing of Trayvon Martin, and when we in the civil society world began to realize that ALEC was actually promoting the laws that led to the acquittal of George Zimmerman, and some say also the actual direct killing of Trayvon Martin himself, when that information came out, a lot of organizations began to realize that ALEC needed to feel some pressure for what they've done and some accountability. So there were a lot of corporations that were more sort of public-facing corporations that felt that pressure more than others and did step away. But that is not by any means the end of the story. There's still several hundred corporations involved.
I want to ask both of you this question. Jacinta, you first. How can we resist ALEC? What kinds of political and legislative tactics are used to mitigate the harm of corporate capture?
Well, there's so much that people can do. I mean, the reason that we decided to participate in this lawsuit was really to continue to expose what's happening. And we know that that law strategy or legal strategies are just one element of kind of what people can do. We've seen communities gather outside of ALEC. There was a rally with over 18 organizations participating in Phoenix to put direct pressure, to be able to call out what's happening. But we know that people can just put pressure on their elected officials to not be part of ALEC. We know that to have a thriving democracy, we need to be able to separate corporate money from the policies that are governing our lives. And so we know that there's a lot more that people can do to pressure their legislatures to say, do not participate in ALEC. We also know that there's tons of corporate campaigns that can happen to ask these corporations to also be accountable. You know, we as Mi Gente have been having a campaign called the No Check for ICE campaign, where we've been targeting companies like Palantir, Amazon, that are creating sort of the surveillance strategies for ICE and the technology that they use to go after our communities. So we know that we can also bring the fight directly to the doorsteps of these companies and make sure that they're accountable for their actions and for how they're using their money to influence politics.
Dom?
Yeah, I think Jacinta's spot on there. I think if the real push here is for lawmakers to leave, I think that's lawmakers just need to honor what is a general compact between voters and their representatives. They need to be directly responsible to everyday people. And I think everyone understands that. It's time that they step away. So, I mean, if those of you active online, you could go to bit.ly/ stop ALEC. And that will give you the opportunity to find your local lawmaker, communicate with that lawmaker and say, look, step away from ALEC. That's the right thing to do. So you can find that online. So it's bit.ly/stop ALEC, which is STOPALEC. So you can go to bit.ly/stop ALEC. You can communicate. You'll find there the way that the page is set up. That you can identify by through the links there to your lawmaker and communicate with them. And that's a wonderful way to do it. That's direct democracy at its best. The other thing, though, is if you're an active community group or you have connection with your local lawyers in your communities, there's a bunch of other things you can do. You could use open records laws. Those of us who know how to use those, basically very simple process. You can write a letter requesting from your lawmaker any information related to its involvement in ALEC. And that lawmaker is required by open records laws to turn over that information. If they refuse to give you that information, you can contact organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights and get our support in actually pushing them to reveal that information. And there's very important information in there. They might have receipts for a trip that they've been on. Which will show that they've been. There might be other diary entries, calendar entries, which will reveal that they've been involved in ALEC. So open records is a good one. Open meeting laws. So if those of you who know that ALEC is coming to your town, they'll be in Florida in 2020, in July. If you want to make sure your lawmaker doesn't attend ALEC, you should write to your lawmaker and say, we think that this isn't in compliance with open meetings law. We think that you should be meeting in the public. You should be having meetings in a way that the general public knows where you're meeting, what you're talking about, where we can access the notes and the draft laws that you're creating. So that's another one. And also for those of you who realize that there is a law coming to your state that you believe ALEC has had a hand in creating, our advice is to go and be present when the committees that are happening in your state are debating those laws and make your voice heard. You have a right to have your voice heard in any of those committee debates. That's another great way to actually show put some pressure on these laws.
Jacinta, what kind of continual organizing are you doing out in Arizona?
You know, in Arizona, there's a lot of really amazing local organizations like WENT, the Human Rights Movement, who's another one of the plaintiffs, that have been doing work not only around fighting back against some of these anti-immigrant laws and fighting against the immigrant detention centers, but have also been fighting again against the women's prisons, the prisons where we have so many of our people incarcerated. But for us, as Mi Gente, at a national level, again, we've been doing the No Tech for ICE campaign, where people can find more information at notechforice.com. Targeting some of these companies. So that's been a very national movement where we've been able to get people involved literally from Palo Alto, California to New York City, targeting these companies protesting outside and getting involved in ways to expose the surveillance state that is being built up in this moment to continue to control communities of color.
Jacinta Gonzalez, how can people get in touch with you at Mi Gente, and how can they follow your work?
Folks can follow us at mijente.net or at conmijente, conmijente, on social media. Or folks can email us directly through the website. And again, the information on the No Tech for ICE campaign is notechforice.com.
Dom, how can people get in touch with the CCR? And I understand that you've issued this report, which you've been talking about. How can people get that report?
Yeah, great. The website for the report is www.alecattacks.org. You can find out more and follow us online on Facebook at the Center for Constitutional Rights and on Twitter at the CCR. If you wanted to email us, it's info@ccrjustice.org.
What corporations have you forced out of ALEC?
I can't take any credit for that myself, but I know that the Color of Change folks and the Center for Media and Democracy and others have done a fantastic job at pushing out a lot of those organizations. One of the best ones that I heard of was Exxon. Exxon finally got out. There's really interesting debate about how ALEC members are fighting about whether they should continue this cock and bull about climate change not existing. And then for all of you out there putting pressure on large-scale oil and gas companies to make them realize that they should no longer fund this climate denial stuff, they're feeling that heat. They felt the need to step away. So keep going if you're doing that.
Jacinta, do you have any final thoughts?
You know, ALEC is one very big part of the pie, but for us, it really is about just increasing more and more organizing to be able to ensure that our communities have a voice in our democracy and that corporations aren't taking control and shaping these policies. So thank you so much for the time and the space.
Well, you do terrific work, and thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Dom, do you have any final thoughts before I have to say goodbye?
Yeah, I just wanted to really echo a little bit of what Jacinta was saying there. I mean, this is a story about ALEC, but it's actually a story about self-governance. I mean, those of you out there who really care about your system of democracy and government and really want your lawmakers to represent you, that's what this fight is about. We shouldn't let these, you know, special private clubs where corporations and other interests just run the show privately. It's time for that to end. We're running out of time on so many fronts. And one of the key thing that holds us all together is pulling back. We need to take back control of our democratic processes.
Dominic Renfrey and Jacinta Gonzalez, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you. We'd like to have you back. You can report on more victories here. You two, take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Michael, I'm sorry that I have to call in to do our host chat, but as you know, I'm laid up with a broken ankle.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I applaud your devotion to the show. We're going to talk about a movie, aren't we?
We are, because as you know, I've been watching a lot of movies from home lately, and I think you have too. I was thrilled to see the recent film called The Report, about a subject that you, Michael Ratner, and I talked about over a decade ago, and that is the CIA's investigation into the U.S. government's use of torture and extraordinary rendition, and the report they wrote, which was then hacked. This film, I thought, did a really terrific job of telling that story. What did you think about it?
I thought the film was rigorous and riveting. I thought they did a magnificent job. I streamed it on Netflix. The film is written and directed by Scott Burns, and it stars Adam Driver and Annette Bening, two extremely fine actors. Scott Burns chose Adam Driver to play the part of Dan Jones, the man who worked under Senator Dianne Feinstein, who was head of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate. The Intelligence Committee, under Dan Jones's investigation, produced a 7,000-page report, which was then reduced because of the pressure from the CIA down to 500 pages, and that was heavily redacted. But it still tells the story. It tells the story about how the CIA hired these two psychologists, Jensen and Mitchell, and they paid them $80 million. And these two guys designed a torture program that the CIA then initiated. The brains behind it all was Vice President Cheney. And I remember how much we both liked the movie Vice, which talks about Cheney. But in any case, Obama refused to prosecute these torturers. When Trump was elected, he said, he lied. He said that torture works. It doesn't work. Now we're faced with a situation that needs to be exposed, and this movie really did a good job on doing it. What did you think, Heidi?
Well, yes, I agree with everything you said. I wanted to remind you that in one of our earlier shows, it might have been the segment that we're going to play for listeners in a few minutes because it stands up beautifully to the test of time, but remember we spent at least one segment on the topic of John Yoo, who was asked to create a memo essentially justifying the use of torture by legalese and twisting words. And so I was really glad that they actually included that scene of John Yoo meeting with some colleagues in the legal department and talking about, the wording to skirt really the letter of the law.
The law in America and internationally, and has been for a long time, that torture is illegal. And what you did in order to get around the law was to redefine torture. So his new definition of torture was that pain has to rise to the level of organ failure before we can call it torture. For his good efforts, John Yoo was named a full professor of law at the University of California in Berkeley.
I think the point being, as you were starting to get at, because there were across-the-board failures to hold the leaders responsible for these practices, and as you said, using multi-million dollar contractors to do the actual hands-on torturing, the government has once again operated with stealth and with impunity in using an inhumane, unlawful technique that doesn't work.
The movie is called The Report. It's streaming on Netflix. Heidi and I thought it was just a marvelous depiction of what this government did behind our backs. And we had a discussion with Michael Ratner, who passed away 3 years ago, about this. And the points we made in this discussion hold true to this very day.
Let's take a listen now to the segment that we did from August 2009, 10 years ago.
Heidi Bogosian, Michael Ratner, you've obviously been following the stories in the New York Times the last several days about how Attorney General Eric Holder is reconsidering the whole torture situation and has appointed a prosecutor looking into it. Is this a good or a bad development or something else?
It's all a big cover-up, Michael. It's all outrageous. I mean, it's really disturbing. It was obviously a huge week or last 2 weeks of revelation of documents that we've been hoping to get unredacted for many years now, particularly the ACLU, but the Center and Amnesty International and Physicians for Human Rights have had requests in for these documents, interestingly, way ahead of the journalists. I mean, no journalists have ever done very much on this. But what came out, what finally came out, was a 50% redacted CIA Inspector General report on the CIA interrogation techniques. It was done through 2004, so it doesn't include anything after that. It goes up to that. What was not given was the what's called the Office of Professional Responsibility report, which is the report on what the lawyers did. But focusing on the CIA Inspector General's report for 2004, what you see in the papers is that Eric Holder, our Attorney General, is supposedly, well, is going to and did appoint a guy named Durham to be the special prosecutor, not an independent prosecutor, a special prosecutor, and he's only to look at what we would call above-the-line torture. What I mean by above-the-line torture is everything at a certain line and below, which is abuse, torture, inhuman treatment, is not to be looked at because that, quote, was authorized by the CIA, by memos, by the president, by Rumsfeld, by every higher official in our government. And it's only those few lower-level CIA agents that supposedly went above the line of what the torture they were allowed to do that might be looked at by this, quote, special prosecutor. It's not a quote. It's a special prosecutor.
We're talking about the handful of rogue CIA agents that exceeded the boundaries. But let's talk about what the boundaries are, because I think this is what is so important.
Well, I think that's why this is a fraud, Michael. What they're saying is we're only going to go above those, as you said, who were supposedly rogue, that went beyond what the boundaries were. This investigation is complete BS, and why it's so disgusting is what we're about to talk about, is what were the boundaries? What did Bush and company allow to occur, not just allow, but in every detail, really laid out exactly how to torture people and how to abuse them.
And then monitored from the White House by the hour.
Overseen by managers, lawyers, and doctors.
Right.
Each of these things. And when you think about these things, you know, we follow this closely at the center. The lawyers follow it. We all look at this, and you hear all this stuff is, well, was this legal under the torture convention? Was this not legal? Was this? It's like going through a rat through a maze trying to find a way through the language of these statutes. But it's all BS. Heidi?
Now, we're not just talking waterboarding, which everyone knows has been going on.
No, what we're talking about, here's what they allowed. And this is just, you can read this everywhere now. This is what they allow. For example, 2 17-watt fluorescent bulbs illuminated each cell 24 hours a day. White noise, which is like just noise, was never to exceed 79 decibels. You could be doused with water that was 41 degrees, but only for 20 minutes at a stretch. You could then...
So that's water that's just above freezing for 20 minutes at a time.
Yeah, let me add some to this. 1,500 calories a day, which is a minimal diet. When you're first captured, they shave your head and your beard and put you in a diaper. The attention slap was allowed.
What's that?
When the interrogator first... Yeah. When the interrogator first approaches interrogee, he slaps him across the face to get their attention.
Number of hours they could be kept in a box. 8 hours for the large box, 2 hours for the small box.
And that's like a coffin.
Right. The proper time when his enforced nudity should be ended and his clothes returned. And then, as Michael said, they're brought to a black site. Their head and face were shaved, stripped, photographed, sleep deprivation, a diet limited to ensure. And then, of course, in the end of this whole thing, and not the end, but then they can be laying up, put on a concrete floor, but then they said, no, you have to put a plastic sheet under them, and you can douse them with cold water for how many minutes? I forget.
Up to 20.
20 minutes. 20, and 41 degrees to induce hypothermia.
And that's not even waterboarding yet, and then you can waterboard. So these are things that are allowed. And you have to ask yourself, you know, they keep saying, well, they give these, John Yoo, these complex formulas about legality and everything. But, you know, when you sit back and just take a step back, since when can you ever treat another human being like that anywhere in the world, in any country that would call itself civilized? Any country. Think about it. I mean, yes, people abuse this all the time, but do they do it from the top with legal memos detailing every single kind of thing you can do? No, they don't, because they don't. No one would argue that it's legal, except for the Bush administration, and now except for the Obama administration, saying, well, we're not going to even look into that. We're going to look into somebody. If you hit them with water, it's 39 degrees instead of 41, then we're going to allow it, not allow it.
They're saying, well, these people were not going to prosecute the higher-ups because they were only following orders. They were acting in good faith. But I think that these practices were first implemented, and then the legal memorandums were written afterwards to justify what they were doing. So the lawyers like John Yoo should be prosecuted for this, and the people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush, who ordered these lawyers to write these rationalizations, should be prosecuted as well. But they're all being ignored. The only people that are going to be prosecuted are like the hillbillies on the night shift.
These few things that have come out
of the rogues.
The headlines, the mock execution, the threats to kill the kids, those are bad. But those were the little things supposedly above the line.
Yeah.
In fact, all these legal memos, as we just said, it's complete BS, because how could anybody in the military, in the CIA, in the government, believe that you could pick a human being up anywhere in the world, put them into a so-called secret cell, and then do what we just said to them? Put them on the ground, little piece of plastic, throw water on them for 20 minutes at a time, take the temperature down, play the music, shave them, diaper them, put them in sleep deprivation, put them in isolation. How could anybody in the world believe you could treat another human being like that, no matter how many I don't care if you had legal memos stacked from here to the moon. You can't do it. And I think that's why, in the end, people in this country at the higher level, these officials are going to be prosecuted in other countries, because this is completely unacceptable.
And illegal.
There is no bite to this special prosecutor.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
He's not a special prosecutor.
He's a special prosecutor, but a special prosecutor
is not independent.
Right. There's two kinds, a special prosecutor and an independent prosecutor. A special prosecutor reports to the Attorney General Holder everything he or she does. Yeah. So in this case, Durham will report everything he does to Holder, and Holder has said he will only look at people who did what he calls above-the-line torture, not below-the-line torture. And that we're only talking about, according to this report, a half a dozen investigations. And there's articles in the Times and papers every day saying this will be impossible. It's many years afterwards. Witnesses are gone. This is all they're talking about. So this so-called special prosecutor is not an independent prosecutor. He's under the literal thumb of Eric Holder, our attorney general.
Yeah, it's a sham and a diversion. And the bottom line is that this stuff is illegal. It's been illegal for many years. There's an American law against it. There's international law against it. That was what was ignored. They created their own laws, and now they're going to prosecute people who they say didn't go by their own laws.
But aside from the damage to this country and our reputation, we are now subject to other countries looking at us and saying, well, if the U.S. can do this, we can do it. And what credibility do we have anymore as a so-called human rights leader? We're not. We're a primary violator.
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. We're actually a completely primary, fundamental violator. I'll just read you, just to give you a sense of what this says. Here's the kinds of records they had to include, according to the top-level CIA and government people. The required records, the medical supervisors said, there were medical supervisors. This is a doctor.
It's just like the Nazis, you know?
Right, playing, right, exactly, Michael. I think included, quote, how long each application lasted, how much water was used in the process, how much realizing that much splashes off, how exactly the water was applied. This is to waterboarding. If a seal was achieved, if the naso or orif part of your throat was filled, what sort of volume was expelled? How long was the break between applications? And how the subject looked in between each waterboarding treatment? When the doctors gauged what a drenching in a cold cell might do to a prisoner, they did their research, consulting various books like Wilderness Medicine, Survival in Cold Waters. I mean, this is really...
Can we find out who the physicians are? Because quite honestly, I think they should lose their license.
Dr. Mengele. We should look for him in Argentina and Bolivia.
We should look for him in Arlington, Virginia.
No, that's right. The doctors we have. There's a whole... Actually, the center has a website. If you go to the Center for Constitutional website, we're following the doctors very closely, and there's a number of people in both the American Psychological Association as well as medical associations going after the doctors. But it's doctors, lawyers, officials, CIA, government, this whole thing, as I think as Michael pointed out, and it's a diversion to look at the few rogue guys, so-called rogue, which we're not even sure they were rogue, you know, when they threatened a guy with a gun. And one question that got asked on my listserv the other day, of course, is one of the threats, the above-the-line torture was to Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, I think, was they had his two children in custody, that they would harm or kill his children or something to him, something to that effect.
And then they waterboarded him like 100 times.
And then the question is, where are those children and what's happened to them?
Yeah.
And that's, and you know, when you hear, remember, put this context of the threat to the children into what John Yoo said on a radio show when a friend of mine asked him, well, do you think the president could do anything in the name of national security, even crush the testicles of one of the children of the people you're interrogating? And you said, well, yes, he could. It depends on the circumstances, but yes. So think about that, and think about that the children of some of these people are still missing. So we're talking about a complete fraud that's being perpetrated on the American people, that Holder is somehow disagreeing with Obama and pushing prosecutions of the few rogue agents. It's a complete BS business. What's going on here is awful. Read the stuff. You can go on websites and find these actual, they're redacted heavily, these documents. We'll put them up on our website. One is at the Washington Post website, one is at the Independent, and another at the ACLU website as well.
Michael, I have a question. When the Center and other organizations filed years ago to get copies of these, you said you asked for unredacted copies. Is that ever possible?
Well, unredacted or mostly unredacted. Most. And what happened with this particular report is it was sent, they first gave a very redacted copy to the request that was by the ACLU CCR, Physicians for Human Rights. And then the judge sent it back to actually having them include more. They issued it again without including very much more, still 50% redacted. And the people on my listserv wonder what the heck is going on, because they say that they don't want to give the techniques to Al-Qaeda and everybody like that because it'll help them. But think about it. If they're not supposed to use these techniques anymore, supposedly, why would they care what comes out? Well, they claim now that it'll inflame Al-Qaeda and all that.
The techniques are published on the first page of the New York Times. These are not secret techniques.
But there may be techniques worse than what we're even hearing about that we can't imagine.
Well, the worst one is what Al McCoy talked to us about years ago, and that's total sensory deprivation. The CIA spent hundreds of millions of dollars using the best universities in America and Canada to learn that if you totally deprive people of any of their senses, you can break down the human spirit in a very short time.
48
and that's
hours
why we see people with blindfolds and earphones on and gloves on. You know, you see when they've been captured. That's according to the CIA plan, to isolate them within their own brain and make them go crazy.
Here's one of the defenders of the program. David Rifkin, who writes a lot about defending this program, he used to work for the Reagan administration. He says, quote, elaborate care went into figuring out the precise gradations of coercion.
Yeah.
Yes, it's jarring, but it shows how both the lawyers and the non-lawyers tried to do the right thing.
Yeah.
In other words, that they looked so precisely at how they tortured people. Heidi?
And determining that slight threshold, which for every individual is different. But even the fact that we're discussing this is stunning.
Well, you know what it reminds me of,
Heidi? Violates all norms of human rights law.
The banality of evil, the famous book that Hannah Arendt wrote. You know, for a guy like this to talk about the gradations of torture is the banality of evil.
You know, I actually say, I have trouble, as I said earlier, I have trouble even beginning to understand this at all, because it's all so outside of how any human being should be treated in any kind of context that we've known for hundreds of years, that it's hard to understand how they can just say, well, we're just going to go after the people who went above what we said could be done to you in the employment of torture. It's so incredible to me. I can't get my hands around it.
But let me shift the discussion here for a second and ask you this question, Heidi. The defense of all this stuff is Cheney's defense. To a certain extent, we have to use this. How much we have to use depends, but only using this gives us security. Heidi, do you think that kind of defense line has been sold effectively to the American people?
Well, we remember back in Nixon's days when the Supreme Court held that the president could not overreach in the name of national security. And what I think has happened since the Nixon days is a continuing diminution in the eyes of the public about faith in government. And so I think combined with what we see on TV and in the media of corruption and really anything goes and it's all war, 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 us against them, the vilification of others, I think the mass media, less than scrupulous standards of those in power, has brought us to a really dangerous point where people just have no faith in those who were elected to take charge of this government. And so I think I am stunned that the public isn't taking to the streets about this. But we haven't seen that. We've seen the suppression of any outrage toward government so systematized over the last couple of decades that I think there's a general apathy about it. Torture has become commonplace.
I think that's right, Heidi. I mean, it's all like, it is right that people just, it's shocking.
Sort of like the Stockholm syndrome. You rationalize when someone who, say, has abducted you, very quickly they say the person, to sort of rationalize being in this awful predicament, takes the side of that person. And I wonder if a variation of that is happening.
I want to go back to that question Michael asked about Cheney. Cheney had, up until revelation of these documents, said that, well, if some of these documents come out, it'll demonstrate that these, quote, what he calls enhanced interrogation techniques, what we call torture, were necessary, and we got good intelligence from people by using these enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, Cheney last week issued a statement after the revelation of these documents and the two that he had been demanding that he claimed would support that torture works. And here's what he said, and it's a very interesting couple of sentences. Cheney said, the documents released Monday, this is last Monday, clearly demonstrate that the individuals, listen carefully, that the individuals subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques provided the bulk of intelligence we gained about Al-Qaeda. The detainees also, according to these documents, played a role in the capture of nearly every Al-Qaeda. But listen to this language, that the individuals subject to these techniques provided the bulk of intelligence. As the articles coming out now on this statement, who've analyzed Cheney's statement, they call it a walk back by Cheney. Because if you listen carefully, what Cheney doesn't do is connect enhanced interrogation techniques to the bulk of intelligence that was gotten. All he says is the bulk of intelligence was gotten from the high-value detainees. He doesn't say that it was the result of the enhanced interrogation techniques. And when you read the documents, it clearly was not the result of the enhanced interrogation techniques. So all that Cheney's saying, as some of the journalists said, this one, Greg Sargent said, all Cheney's saying is that the same individuals who were tortured also happened to yield the most important evidence about Al-Qaeda. He's not saying that the documents prove torture was responsible for providing that info. So these documents actually put to lie that Cheney's claim that the torture somehow gained information.
Even worse, Heidi, you remember the person they tortured who gave evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and that was used at the UN speech to justify the war against Iraq, and then it turned out that the evidence was totally false, and the only reason he gave it was he was being tortured. It's even worse. It's not only that torture doesn't work, that torture yields false evidence, and in this case, they used it to launch the war.
Exactly. That puts us in a worse situation. We all know that torture doesn't work. We've had so many experts on this show to talk about that. But someone desperate will say anything to get out of the situation.
And I think your point, Michael's point about the Iraq war, which one of the earliest uses of torture was to apparently just get the information from some supposed informer or somebody, a turncoat,
to use his justification.
To use justification for the war in Iraq, and was all BS. It was Powell relied on at the UN speech.
That's right.
And it was all a way of selling the war to the American public. So it's been a very, very bad couple of weeks on the torture issue. You're seeing a bit of scrambling by the administration with the so-called special prosecutor who's not independent, but you're seeing a complete ignoring, and worse than ignoring, of the torture program in the United States. And I say worse than ignoring because as soon as you only prosecute people who've gone above the line, above the torture line that they have, what are you saying about the torture below the line, except that it was okay?
And business as usual.
Right. And so it's a very bad set of circumstances.
But I think we have to say that but for organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the work that the Lawyers Guild did on it, the good work that the ACLU did on it, none of this would have come out. And you wouldn't even have the marginal investigation that you have now.
So it's absolutely critical that we keep this fight up. And I think ultimately that other courts in the world will go after the U.S. for this. But this is a setback. I consider this a 500-year setback. Then when the major country in the world, the most important country from an economic and military point of view, and supposedly for human rights, although I think that's quite questionable, really invokes and becomes part of a torture program and conspiracy then what can you say about any other country in the world that follows the United States lead?
Yeah,
and essentially, it set back civilization hundreds of years.
Yeah, I think it's a setback, too. I think that what Obama's done is tied a pretty pink bow on this whole torture program. And this diversion will peter out because these prosecutions, to the limited extent that they're even looking into it, aren't going to happen. And the whole thing will be put aside. No one will be held accountable for the torture program that this country carried out for all those years under Cheney and Bush.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Oh,